Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Nina Kim. Coming up on Forum, how often do you check your smartphone? How much time do you spend on it? Are you worried you might be addicted to your phone? Kashmir Hill was, so she switched to an old-school flip phone for a month, wondering if it would make a difference. Would she be able to stop relying on maps and apps? Would she be able to do her job as a tech reporter for the New York Times? It was inconvenient for sure, Hill says, but during her month off, she thrived. We'll find out why and get tips for reducing your own phone use after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When New York Times tech reporter Kashmir Hill started getting worried about how much time she spent on her smartphone, she decided to try downgrading to a bare-bones dumb phone, a flip phone, for a month.
It makes phone calls and texts, and that was about it. It didn't even have Snake on it.
But the switch was a lot easier said than done, including the logistics of just getting the flip phone. So, was it all worth it? Here to tell us what happened during her month-long break from her smartphone is Kashmir Hill. Welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. So tell me, how much were you using your smartphone before you switched to the flip phone?
So I get those weekly screen time reports from Apple. And for me, it was regularly over 5 hours a day. 1 week, it went up to 9 hours a day, which I can't even understand how I looked at my phone that much. And I was thinking about this in December of last year. And so I added up, you know, how much time over the full year I'd spent looking at my phone. And if we're only talking about waking hours, it was 4 months of the year.
And that was making you feel pretty bad, right? Like, you talked about how grasping your phone gave you this queasy feeling. What was the feeling?
Yeah, I just started to feel like I didn't have control over the use of the phone and that I was reaching for it habitually. Like, every time I got a little bit bored, I was pulling it out and looking at it and seeking out that stimulation. And I was starting to feel so much anxiety around how much I was using it.
So you decide to ditch your smartphone, go to a flip phone, which means that all you can really do with your phone is make calls and texts on it. But it sounds like to even have this privilege, you had to get one of those phones. And getting one of those old phones was a bit of a process in and of itself.
Yeah, it was hard. I thought I could just kind of go online and order it. But my cell phone provider wouldn't let me. I called them to try to order it. And they said, you're going to have to do this in the store. And so I went with my two daughters and who are young. They were at the time 6 and 3. And they were just laughing at me. Like, they picked up, it's an Orbic Journey. I mean, just as basic a phone as you can imimagine, with those little plastic keys, you know, 1 through 9. And my daughter was like, really? This is the phone that you want? Are you serious?
So you couldn't really choose the phone that you wanted. They had only the one phone.
Yeah. My carrier only had one dumb phone, so-called dumb phone, on offer, which was frustrating because this isn't the one that I wanted. There are other better kind of dumb phone models out there, but my carrier wouldn't allow those ones on the network.
We have a clip, actually, of you talking with your carrier about trying to get a flip phone. Let's hear a little bit of that.
All right, so we're upgrading from your iPhone 15 to the flip phone.
Upgrading?
All right, so we're playing. We're downgrading. Like, I don't know, however like, you want to.
More like downgrading.
Whatever you want to say.
Yeah, the decision to upgrade to the Journey was apparently so preposterous that my carrier wouldn't allow me to do it over the phone.
Yeah, I don't know why it offers that, and then we cannot upgrade the customers to this. But you're more than welcome to get your flip phone online.
Okay.
Or walk into a Spectrum mobile store.
Do you think they even... I had to go to the store.
Hey, I'm good. I am trying to switch to a dumb phone, like a flip phone.
Like a flip phone? Okay.
And I wonder if you guys carry them in this store.
Yeah, we do. You do? We have them in stock, though. Give me 1 second.
Okay, thanks.
That's my guest, Kashmir Hill, trying to switch to a flip phone. And Kashmir, you're describing how your daughter was sort of horrified at the look of it. You described all like the little number button keys, but what did the screen look like?
The screen is, I'm looking at it right now. I still actually have it. It's super, I mean, it feels like 90s technology. It's a really tiny little screen. It does have color, but it's kind of dull. It's not like the bright colors of a smartphone. And yeah, it's got like a touch menu. I do have to use buttons. You know, I can't do a touch screen. Yeah, it's funny. It is very much a throwback.
And so can you describe, because there are people who've never had to do this, what texting is like on a phone like that?
Okay. So if you want to do the word cat, you have to hit the 2 button multiple times. So, you know, if you want the C, you have to hit it 1, 2, 3, and then you get the C, and then you hit the 2 button twice to get, or get it once to do the A. Oh, I'm sorry. And then you need to do an 8 to get the T. Yeah, it is just, it's highly manual. So I started writing very, very short text messages, or better yet, calling people, which people don't like. People don't actually want their phone to be called or used as a phone.
So they weren't picking up when you were calling?
My calls went to voicemail very often, and I would leave voicemails, and either the person wouldn't call me back or they would send me a text in reply.
And how was that for you, leaving voicemails? Was that weird until you got used to it?
I described it in the piece as like as reliable as putting a message in a glass bottle and throwing it out to sea. You just didn't know if somebody listened to it or not. I remember leaving a detailed voicemail for my sister around Christmas time, saying all the boxes that I was sending and who they were for. And then I got a text message from her later that implied she had not listened to this voicemail and had no idea what to do with these boxes that arrived.
We're talking about Kashmir Hill's experience downgrading to a flip phone to be able to get control of her phone use, the amount of time that she spent on it, which we found was an astonishing more than 5 hours a day, sometimes even up to 9 occasionally. And you listeners are invited to join the conversation. Have you thought about switching to a flip phone or trying to take steps to reduce your phone time? What have you tried? What has worked? What hasn't? Or maybe what questions do you have for Hill about making that switch? You can email forum@kqed.org, find us on our social channels at KQED Forum, or call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786 on whatever phone you have. But Kashmir, so there was some real inconvenience, though. In addition to that, there were a lot of inconveniences with regard to the fact that you have an electric vehicle and so on. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, I mean, we live in a society now that kind of requires you to have a smartphone in certain cases. So yes, with my electric vehicle, I pulled into a charger at one point low on miles and then realized I could not sign in without my smartphone to scan that QR code. Two-factor authentication was a problem because there's so many apps on my, I use an app on my phone to provide a second factor to kind of sign into some accounts. And what was really hard for me was mapping. The part of my brain that knows how to get around has withered away. And basically, if I'm going anywhere more than kind of 15 minutes away, I tend to plug the address into Google Maps and get directions to walk there or to drive there. And so, yeah, I had to figure out how to navigate without maps. And it was really hard at first. I got lost so many times driving around the area where I live. I realized, wow, I don't know the names of roads. I don't know how to get anywhere more than 15 minutes away.
And you also overdrew your bank account because you didn't get those alerts.
I usually am very good. I mean, it's actually one of the things I love about the smartphone is I can check my financial accounts there. And so I've gotten into the habit of, you know, monitoring my bank account and realizing when it's getting too low and then moving money over from my, you know, high yield savings account. And I didn't do that. I wasn't checking it. And so yeah, I overdrew the account and had to pay an overdraft fee.
I was also, you know, struck by the fact that you couldn't set up devices you received or bought because they required a smartphone app to set up. It is really incredible, as you say, how much our life is built around the expectation that we have a smartphone. And then as a tech journalist, which is my biggest fear, is that as a journalist, I would not be as aware of what's going on in the world, or I'd be less connected. Did you experience that?
I got this question a lot from my colleagues at the Times. They said, do you feel less well-informed? Yeah. And I didn't. I felt less quickly informed. You know, I wasn't getting notifications on the go, but I still had access to technology. I just started doing more things on my computer. And so, yeah, you don't lose touch as much as you think you're going to. We just have really become so dependent on our phones. And most of us, you know, we never even turn off our smartphone. It's there 24/7, either on our body, you know, next to us, you know, next to us while we're sleeping. We just have gotten really tied to these devices in a way that I think is unhealthy.
Yeah. Well, we've got calls coming in. Let me go to Vinod in Gilroy. Hi, Vinod.
Hi. Good morning. It was a nice conversation I'm hearing about. Actually, I had the same problem for the past couple of years. I've been trying to downgrade or like reduce my screen time, but I couldn't do so because I'm in an IT field. So I'm thinking of something like downgrading slowly. For example, if I use a lower model of a phone, of an iPhone, like I'll not get app support for some of the most recent apps. Mm. So with these kind of activities, I was thinking like I can slowly downgrade my addiction to the smartphones. So thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, the updates, that makes a lot of sense, Vinod, and how they're structured. Did people say anything to you, Kashmir, when they noticed you were using a flip phone?
I definitely got strange looks when I got out the flip phone, and people would immediately ask why I had it. And when I explained what I was doing, that I felt too dependent on my smartphone and I wanted to take a break, I would hear either I could never do that, or people would say, I wish I could do that. And then people would start confessing their smartphone sins to me. And yeah, telling me, oh gosh, like, I know I check it too much. I look at it while I'm driving. I look at it when I should be playing with my kids. Like, I really wish I could get away from it. One of my colleagues actually said, oh, you should propose something called Flip Phone February, like Dry January, where we give up our smartphones for a month and kind of revisit our habits, try to form better habits around tech use.
I loved your description of how your black clamshell of a phone had the effect of a clerical collar.
It really was. I mean, I just think this is such a universal feeling right now. There's very few people I encounter who say, oh yeah, I use my phone the perfect amount. I am really healthy about it. It is every once in a while there's somebody like that, but I think it's more the other, and that people are really struggling with this. I mean, there's so many benefits that come with the phone, but it's also like a casino, like a slot machine, where we're so drawn to the stimulation of it that we're overusing the devices.
Yeah, well, right after the break, we'll hear exactly what that is, what's happening in our brains that makes us feel that way. We're talking with Kashmir Hill. Her recent New York Times piece is called I Was Addicted to My Smartphone, So I Switched to a Flip Phone for a Month. She's telling us about her experience, and we're hearing from you, our listeners. Do you feel addicted to your phone, or that you use it excessively and are worried about it? Have you tried to switch to a flip phone or taken steps to reduce your phone time? How did it go? Email address forum@kqed.org. Our social channels are @KQEDForum. On X, Instagram, or our digital community. Our phone number, 866-733-6786. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about our relationships with our phones, why we may feel addicted to them, and the practicalities of trying to reduce our screen time, potentially by downgrading to a dumb phone or a flip phone. Kashmir Hill, tech reporter for the New York Times, tried it, and her piece is I Was Addicted to My Smartphone, So I Switched to a Flip Phone for a Month. And you, our listeners, are sharing your questions and experiences trying to reduce your screen time at 866-733-6786 or by emailing forum@kqed.org. or posting online on our social channels. I want to bring into the conversation Anna Lemke, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford, also author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Anna, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm enjoying the conversation.
So I'm so struck by Keshmir describing the number of people who were saying they'd really like to do this. They feel addicted to their phones and telling her a whole bunch of stories. What is happening that makes us feel like we are losing control or that we have this urge to use our phones that we cannot manage very well?
Our digital devices and the digital media that we access through those devices lights up the same brain reward pathway as drugs and alcohol. It releases dopamine, our reward and pleasure neurotransmitter, requiring our brains to accommodate that increased dopamine by downregulating dopamine transmission and production. So what we're doing every time we check our smartphone, or for that matter, go on our screens more broadly, is we're titillating or tickling that brain reward pathway, causing physiologic stress and accommodation or adaptation. And with repeated use, we're essentially leading our brains to downregulate dopamine, again, not just to baseline, but actually below baseline, into a dopamine deficit state, which creates the state of craving, anxiety, depression, irritability that drives reuse. So what I loved about Keshmir is she articulated perfectly the three C's of addiction: control, compulsion, and consequences. She talked about, quote, "I felt like I didn't have control." Quote, "I felt like I was reaching for it habitually." Quote, "I felt like when I was just a little bit bored, I would reach for my phone." That's exactly what happens in addiction. You get caught in this kind of consumptive loop, which mitigates our ability to actually choose what we're doing. We get chosen for.
Wow, that consumptive loop you talk about. So basically, the scrolling, the seeing, the bright colors, the activity, or whatever else we turn to our phone for releases dopamine, but then all that dopamine release puts us in a deficit state where we need more dopamine and then keep using the very thing that puts us in that dopamine deficit state to begin with. That's the loop you're talking about, right, Anna?
Yes, exactly. So first we're using to sort of get the little high, but after a while we're using just to get out of the hole and feel normal.
Huh. And then you said that Keshmir is describing the three C's of addiction. So do you think addiction is the right term for how to describe this with our phones? Because I know there's been some debate about whether it really applies to devices like phones.
There's no doubt in my mind that the problem of addiction, which is a spectrum disorder, mild, moderate, severe, and even pre-addictive states, applies as well to smartphones as it does to any other intoxicant. Now, not everybody who drinks alcohol will get addicted to alcohol, but about 10 to 15% of the population will experience an alcohol use problem at some point in their life. And the same is true for digital devices. Most of us will identify a problem and be able to find some way to self-correct, like Keshmir has done. But there is a subset of us, likely about 10%, that will end up here in my office because they're dealing with a life-threatening addiction to digital devices and digital media. So anybody who questions, that the possibility of addiction to devices, I metaphorically invite them into my office and the office of many of my colleagues, where we see people who are suicidal because they literally feel they cannot stop using the internet and digital media. So it's a serious problem.
Well, so Ellie on Discord writes, "I'd like to switch back to a flip phone, but the inability to text and have location tracking would probably make it annoying." Noelle writes, "When I got a smartphone, I did not add access to email. I also downloaded a bare minimum of apps. I also made a conscious decision to not become tethered to the phone. Also important is muting notifications. I do that from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. I need some mind space and don't want constant stimulation. I think a lot of the free-floating anxiety so many people experience is from not recognizing the need to unplug and to reset." So yeah, let's talk about approaches we can take to gauge our level of need for our phones, whether it's healthy, whether it's worth it to try to take the steps that Keshmir took. One of the things I was struck by, Keshmir, is that you spoke with a researcher who said just finding out what your phone usage is doesn't always spur people into action the way that it did for you. It doesn't really encourage us to use our smartphones less. Why did they say that?
Yeah, both Google and Apple are kind of aware of this anxiety people feel. And so they introduce these tools to try to help people reduce their screen time. And so you can have these reports and they'll tell you how many hours a day you're looking at your phone. But yeah, this apparently in studies, it just doesn't cause people to change their behavior. The companies also offer tools where you can limit how long you can use particular apps, but it's very easy to circumvent these controls and, yes. and turn them off. And so people do that. And so the researchers I talked to were thinking about what are other things that we could do to more effectively get people to limit their time. And one was tying it to physical activity that, you know, if you were out and about and physical for an hour, maybe you could earn, you know, 15 minutes of phone time. And he said that was an effective method in a study that he had run. Another piece of advice I got that I actually have done now that I've gone back to my smartphone is turning it to grayscale, which makes it like a black and white screen. And in one study, this reduced how often people use their phone by almost 20%.
Well, Rosa writes, our phones are toys for adults. Try changing the screen to black and white. Your phone suddenly becomes quite boring. So it sounds like that's exactly the experience that you had. Anna, what is self-binding and how can we use that as a technique?
Yeah, so self-binding is all the both literal and metacognitive barriers we put between ourselves and our drug of choice, allowing us to press the pause button between desire and consumption. And Kashmir, getting a flip phone, an old-fashioned flip phone, is a form of self-binding, right? It made it that much harder for her to text. It made it that much harder for her to, you know, she couldn't go online from the phone. She had to sit down at her computer. And you're hearing from many different callers the kinds of self-binding strategies that they've been using. And I contend that we really need to have those barriers, those self-binding strategies in place if we're going to be remotely successful at having a healthy relationship with the technology, because we're inundated constantly with invitations to use and to consume. I was optimistic or hopeful initially with just tracking how much we were using would help people use less, but I've become more pessimistic about that over time. And I really have come to believe that people need to take a full-on break, like Kashmir has done, from her smartphone, and in some cases from the internet altogether, to reset reward pathways. And then when they go back to using, have a very specific plan. And I've also become a huge advocate of physically separating from our phones for a period of time and having our phones off by default. There's something really interesting psychologically that happens when our phones are turned off and we know they cannot transmit or receive. It's like they don't take up as much mental space for us when they're not acting as these kind of radio transmitters. So I always advise off by default, then pull it out with intentionality to use it the way that you need to use it as a tool, but not as a drug.
Dr. Anna Lemke is professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford and author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Kashmir Hill is tech reporter for the New York Times and author of Your Face Belongs to Us. And let me go to caller Cynthia in San Francisco. Cynthia, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Go right ahead.
I'm calling in because, first of all, I've never owned or used a smartphone. I'm in my 70s. I'm retired. When I was teaching at the university, I noticed that my students couldn't turn them off in class. And I saw it as an addiction, and I didn't see it as a way to have people come together or communicate with each other. So I decided not to get one, and I've never gotten one. I do have an iPad, so I understand this conversation because now with the iPad, I just check my emails in the morning. I check them maybe later on at night. And everyone who knows me knows if they want to contact me, they have to call me on a phone at my home. I have a landline. And I have a little flip phone that I have when I'm away from the house to communicate just with my father, who's 101 and may need me for something. But I'm telling you now, I may have to get a smartphone because everybody wants to text me to verify my identity when I log in. And I have to have a QR code to do things.
Yes.
So the whole world is not communicating with each other, but I think they're drawing me in.
Yeah, Cynthia, thank you. And that was your whole point, right, Kashmir, that we as a society are set up with the expectation that people have smartphones.
Yeah, I've heard from so many people like Cynthia since this story came out saying, you know, I love that I don't have a phone, or I love that I have a flip phone. It's been so good for me. It's saved my marriage. You know, it's improved my relationship with my children. I just have better mental health. But they describe their struggles that when you go to a sporting event, for example, you know, with Ticketmaster, you're supposed to have a digital, you know, ticket that you show. And often it's hard to get physical tickets, that when they park, the parking machines are usually broken, and that you have to download an app to pay for parking. So people have gotten parking tickets. It's just, there's all these kind of bottlenecks now in society where they just expect that everybody has a smartphone because so many of us do.
Yeah. Let me go to caller Ben in Berkeley. Ben, you're on.
Hi. I just had a comment related to when she went into the cell phone store and asked for a quote dumb phone. Because it made me think of all the other appliances that are out there that are quote unquote smart and require function or, you know, internet connectivity for them to be functional. And so I find it interesting that although there's a lot of callers liking the way of kind of a dumb phone or a dumb thing, it seems like this new technology of smart everything is kind of taking over. And I wonder what you think about this in other spaces that aren't just phones, things like appliances and cars.
Yeah, Ben, thanks. What do you think about that and its impact, Anna, just in terms of all the appliances out there that are moving to this way of interacting with it that draws to them?
There's no putting the genie back in the bottle. I mean, this technology is here to stay. It's deeply integrated into all of our lives. I mean, unless you're living, you know, as an Amish or something comparable. And I hear even the Amish now carry smartphones. So that's why this discussion of temperance or moderation or having a healthier relationship with the technology is going to be the key conversation that we need to have. The technology is deeply embedded. It's cognitively adherent. We love it. And it's not going away. So we have to figure out how to be healthier amidst it.
Kashmir, were you wanting to jump in as well here?
Yeah, this is something where I do think it's important that we allow technologies to operate without connectivity. And for many reasons, I mean, I'm a privacy reporter. So I think a lot about the fact that once something has an internet connection, once it's smart, it can collect data about you. And so I did a whole story about making my house a smart home and then monitoring all the data that was being collected about me by, you know, my vacuum and my bed and my TV. I mean, smart TVs are voracious. And I just did this whole series about cars and how connected cars now are collecting data about how we drive. And in the case of General Motors, we're sharing it with data brokers who are giving it to insurance companies and making people's insurance rates go up. And they just had no idea that their car even was internet connected. So I do think it's a big problem. I'm glad Ben called in about that.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, and I'll just
go ahead, Anna.
Jump in and add that, you know, great point. And not only is it a privacy issue, but it's also contributes to the addictive potential, because the algorithmically generated endless feeds that keep us scrolling are informed by all of the devices, the smart devices that we're using.
Well, listeners, connect to us for conversation at 866-733-6786, on our social channels at KQED Forum, at our email address, forum@kqed.org. A lot of the strategies that we were talking about were sort of individual strategies of self-binding and so on, grayscale and all that kind of thing. But Anna, you've talked about how collective strategies can be useful. What's an example of a collective strategy around our smartphones or phones?
An example of a collective strategy is, for example, a high school that has decided that they will no longer allow their students to have smartphones. And what those schools have discovered is, number one, schools are noisier again because kids are actually talking to each other, which is both wonderful to hear and also tragic to think about when you realize it's a small minority of schools that have implemented those policies. But also when they track well-being and emotional, mental health parameters, those kids feel better. They're less anxious. They're less depressed. So I'm a huge proponent of taking smartphones out of K through 12 as a top-down policy. I think this is really important. I think the federal government and other legislative bodies can incentivize these types of interventions to help us get back to a healthier relationship with the technology. And then you see sort of spontaneously and culturally all kinds of examples of this coming up. For example, the Masters just occurred, and many people may have read that there were no smartphones allowed on the premises. And people talked about it being like a spiritual experience to go a full day gathered together with other people without being in the virtual world simultaneously. So I think more and more we're going to find a desire, a deep desire for this kind of in real life connection that is absent the internet. And I'm eager to see where that will all go.
You talked about, Kashmir, how your social circle actually shrank a tiny bit, or maybe your social interactions or social activity shrank a little bit while you were on your flip phone. I'm thinking about when it comes to collective strategies, you were talking about Flip Phone February, where a group of people did it together. So then maybe if people were doing it together, even if your social interaction shrank a little bit, you'd all kind of understand why?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that a lot of this comes from peer pressure. Like the caller who said that she feels like she kind of needs to get a smartphone because all these people want to text her all the time, that you get kind of sucked into it. And so if you decide as a group, okay, we're all going to switch to dumb phones, which I did talk to a teacher at one of these schools that's done this. They don't make the kids get rid of phones entirely, but they have them switch to flip phones or to light phones or something that basically doesn't have internet. And they say that the students are always super resistant at first, but that once they start doing it, they really enjoy this ability to kind of step away from the internet. And I think that's what we're talking about. When we talk about smartphone, we are talking about the way that the smartphone provides, you know, just 24/7 internet connectivity. And I just think that creates a lot of anxiety, just social media and news and just everything else that is right there that you can do at any moment. It just feels so nice to be able to step away from that.
Kashmir Hill wrote a New York Times piece called "I Was Addicted to My Smartphone, So I Switched to a Flip Phone for a Month." And we're talking about what that experience was like, the social impact that it sounds like it had, the positive and deeper interactions that she was able to have. We're also talking with Dr. Anna Lemke, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford. And we're talking with you, our listeners. Have you switched to a flip phone or taken steps to reduce your phone use? Do you feel addicted to your phone or worry that you're using it excessively? Maybe you feel like you have a healthy relationship with your phone. We're hearing how people have been able to manage that as well. Do you have memories of the flip phone age? And do you think it was better, worse than our current moment? Email address forum@kqed.org. Post on our social channels @KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Why we may feel addicted to our phones and the practicalities of trying to decrease our phone use. That's what we're talking about with Anna Lemke at Stanford University, Kashmir Hill of the New York Times, and with you, our listeners. Greg writes, has Kashmir managed to spend less time on her smartphone since? Okay, Kashmir, so you were talking about 5, sometimes up to 9 hours last year. What's it like for you now?
Yes, I'm glad to be asked this. So, you know, I did this experiment in December, and I have started using my smartphone again. And I have to say this worked. I now use my smartphone around 2 hours a day. So I reduced how much I was using it by quite a lot. And I do, I feel like that I have a healthier relationship with it, and I don't have that same queasiness. I also took it out of my bedroom, and I put it in another room. It has a little table that it lives on, and I turn it off at night. And that has improved my sleep dramatically. And I really recommend that anybody listening get the phone out of your bedroom. You know, ideally turn it off at night.
Well, the sister writes, has the dopamine addiction theory been scientifically confirmed? What is the latest research on phone addiction? Is it affecting mental health correlative or causative? Anna, that's a question for you.
Yeah. So I'll address the correlative causative one. There are lots and lots of studies now showing that the more time that people spend using the internet and on their devices, the more likely they are to experience depression, anxiety, inattention, insomnia, and other mental health burdens. The question is, you know, is it the chicken and the egg? Are these a subset of people who have psychiatric disorders who are then prone to be on the internet, or is it the internet that's causing these psychiatric symptoms? And I would argue, and I think many others agree, that it is the time spent on the internet that is really driving these mental health disorders. And we can base that on many different factors. Number one, the factor of temporality, that we often see the internet use to precede or come before these psychiatric symptoms. There's a very strong strength of association, which tells us that there's a probable strong causative effect. And then there's experimentation. If we go in and we change a variable, like have people get off of their devices, do their symptoms improve? And what we're seeing clinically, and certainly what's beginning to be looked at in clinical work and studies, is that when people get off their devices, their psychiatric problems do improve. So all of that really speaks to a causal direction from the internet to psychiatric problems. Of course, you know, there are individuals, as I said earlier, who are going to be more vulnerable to over-consuming digital media, smartphones, the internet, and that's going to include people with co-occurring mental health disorders. But we really cannot disregard the causal relationship. In terms of your question about the dopamine hypothesis, so unfortunately we don't have like little smartphones yet to give to mice and rats to measure how much they'll use them. We put a probe in their brain and measure dopamine firing, which is what we do for other drugs. But we can infer by analogy that this highly conserved region of the brain that we know is stimulated by screens and digital media and social connection and games and winning and gambling, that you know, it is lighting up the same reward pathway and leading to the same kinds of abnormal dopamine fluctuations that we know drive addiction. Also, if you look just at the phenomenology of the disorders of addiction or overconsumption of digital media and overconsumption of drugs, you see a very similar natural history. People start out using for fun or to solve a problem. If it works, they go back. Over time, they need more. Then they're in withdrawal. And then ultimately, they're garnering all of their life resources toward using the drug, overcoming drug use, lying about it as their drug mistakes it for survival.
Are the kinds of things that happen, like these dopamine states, prolonged dopamine deficit states as well, does it have a worse impact on kids? So many kids and teens have phones, are on screens.
Yeah, kids are a vulnerable subpopulation for so many reasons. When it comes to social media, kids are especially sensitive to social cues, social belonging, social comparisons, you know, which is the sort of foundation of what social media is all about, including the metrics that exploit these social comparisons. Also, a kid's prefrontal cortex and frontal lobes are still in the development stage where they're not yet fully connected to the rest of the brain, where the brain is still cutting back on the neural circuits that an adolescent uses least often, and myelinating or making more efficient the circuits that the adolescent uses most often. And essentially by age 25, we have the neurological scaffolding that we'll have for the rest of our adult lives. So plasticity decreases significantly at that point. So yes, kids are definitely both socially, psychologically, and neurologically more vulnerable.
Let me go to Renee in Orange County. Renee, you're on.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate this particular subject on forum this morning. I like Kashmir Hill's attempt to actually bring some reality. When I was screened, I let everybody know I've been using, I call it a flip phone, for more than 10 years. Mm. And like one of the other callers, I'm retired. I can probably do that. I only access the internet with a laptop. And I did run into authentications. The two-step authentications are very difficult. They're set up primarily for people to take a picture of an ID and then send it through a smartphone. But I've been very, very, very happy. And I can text on my phone, and I haven't had anyone tell me, you need to get a smartphone. It's been I haven't detoxed. I've actually unplugged. I really am not in this new age of technology. I don't want to be glued to a glowing screen that's in one dimension when the world is in actually.
Well, yeah. Well, Renee, thank you for sharing that experience. And Kashima, you've also heard young people express this too, right? You talked with, I think, a college, you know, student who is part of like a Luddite club or something.
Yes, her name is Logan Lane. And when she was in high school, she founded the Luddite club for other students, fellow students who wanted to take a step back from technology. She, during the pandemic, just felt like she was getting obsessed with social media and it was sucking up all of her time and it was making her feel badly about herself. And so she switched to a flip phone and did this club. And it was some people who got flip phones, some people who would just spend this hour together at the weekly meeting away from devices. And so I checked in with her because she's in college now. And I said, are you still using the flip phone? And she was. And she said she loves it. She really hopes that she can use it for the rest of her life. And she had run into a couple of problems. There's an eatery on campus, her favorite one, that only accepts mobile orders. And so she has to have a friend with a smartphone, you know, put in an order for her. And then she ran into this security problem, the two-factor authentication. But there is actually a physical key called a Yubico key that you can order and use if you are a person who wants to use a flip phone but still have security around your accounts.
Yeah, Steve was mentioning that too. Steve on Discord writes, there are other ways to do two-factor authentication, such as physical security tokens. Steve also says, in principle, there's no reason a fingerprint reader or a camera that can do Face ID cannot be put on a flip phone. Another listener asks, has there been any discussion about smartphone regulation in terms of what can be assessed, what can be accessed at certain times and in certain locations? Sometimes I think of smartphones as a health crisis. So Kashima, you did speak with policy experts. They did have ideas for lawmakers. You've also talked about what lawmakers are saying and thinking around this. What have you heard?
Yeah, so I talked to the Center for Humane Technology, which was founded by Tristan Harris, and they really want to see this legislated, particularly for young people. And they've been pushing bills that would say, hey, you can't have, you know, kind of endless scrolling on your platform. It needs to end at some point. And saying like, you can't make these addictive features, like on Snapchat, there's something called the streak. And if you, you know, it basically incentivizes you to log in every single day. There's, you know, some people say that these kinds of things would be unconstitutional, that you're trying to regulate the company's speech. But it's certainly, you know, an idea they have. It's something they're actually pushing, and they're hoping some of these bills get passed. But I think increasingly we're starting to see spaces where, yeah, phones aren't allowed, whether at the Masters, the golf tournament, at concerts now. Sometimes you'll get there and they will take your phone away or put it into a pouch. A lot of comedians don't want their audiences to have smartphones because they don't want to be recorded, and they, you know, they want their crowd's full attention. And so I am seeing this kind of nascent movement in schools as well of trying to create phone-free spaces so people can just be with each other and not have everything mediated through a screen.
Yeah, phone-free spaces are definitely on the rise. The other thing you had mentioned, that Britain has rules for tech products aimed at kids, and one of them was that the autoplay feature can't function. So, which I think would be amazing, because the number of times that I say to my kid, okay, right after this video, and then I don't even realize that the next video has started and they've been on it forever. I mean, let me go to Peter in San Francisco. Peter, you're on.
Yes, hi, glad you're doing this. I had a flip phone for quite a number of years and quit altogether at the end of a little more than a year ago. And after an initial adjustment period of figuring a bit of stuff out, I've just found I'm much less stressed and hassled by constant interruptions. You know, I'm not crossing the street wondering if I should answer this or look at the message. I'm not answering stuff at odd times and interrupting things, like, for example, at a meeting. Sometimes you have to go back and forth, and then the whole meeting is stress because how are you going to communicate at the same time that you're present in the meeting?
So then, Peter, you have a landline at home? Is that what you have?
Exactly. And it doesn't drop phones, and it doesn't drop, and it doesn't interrupt and say, my number is something, something, something. Nor do I get a message like that and so on. So I've found it, in certain respects, it's frustrating when you're left out, as your guests mentioned. But basically, it's much more, you know, I just have to figure it out or let the folks wait until I'm home to get the message. Also, there's a privacy issue. I think regulated landlines have a guarantee of privacy that a judge, upon probable cause, has to approve a wiretap, whereas phones are completely and totally open to whatever the terms are privately that you arrange with the carrier.
Peter, I'm glad you had such a positive experience with that. Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. I'm struck with Peter talking about that adjustment period, which I think you've also talked about, Kashmir, a little bit in terms of the adjustment period. But Patty wants to know, Dr. Lemke, how long do you suggest people take for a real break from screens to reset our neural pathways?
A minimum of 30 days to begin to reset those neurological pathways, to get out of the vortex of craving, and to be able to see true cause and effect, that is to say, the real impact of our smartphone usage or other drug usage on our lives. It doesn't mean that the behavior is magically cured at 30 days, and those first 10 to 14 days are really hard as we experience bona fide withdrawal, the universal symptoms of which are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria, and craving. But usually by 30 days, people feel better, they have more insight and clarity, and many times, like in the case of Kashmir, they can go back to using their digital device with a specific plan and self-finding strategies in place and experience ongoing moderated use. I really want to, though, echo what Peter said. You know, it's the sort of mobile nature and like doing things as we're running for the bus that I think really generates this anxiety, because we're constantly in reactivity mode. Whether the news is good or bad, we're constantly responding to these virtual stimuli. Whereas when we get rid of that smartphone or greatly reduce its use, we're really able to be grounded in space and time in our own bodies and in our own minds and experience the world in a very different and much more positive way.
So then let me ask you two things, Kashmir, based on what Dr. Lemke was just saying. First, how long was your sort of withdrawal period, would you say?
So I would say, so in the first 2 weeks, I actually had this physical urge to reach into my pocket and grab the phone, except when you reach into your pocket and grab the flip phone, there's nothing to really engage with. And I had something I called the thumb twitch, which that my thumb literally kind of yearned to scroll on a screen. And at about the 2 week mark, I noticed it went away. Like I could stand at the elevator in the New York Times building and not have the desire to pick up the phone and look at it. But yeah, it took about 2 weeks for that actual physical urge to go away. And, you know, later into the 30 days, I really started to feel this sense of calm. And like I could concentrate more. I started reading so many books. My husband told me, your face looks less stressed. I mean, I think that phones is just like Dr. Lemke was saying, it's constantly there. It's in your head. You're thinking about it. Some researchers have actually studied giving people tests and asking them to turn the phone off or turn their phone, you know, upside down so they couldn't see the screen, or leaving it in another room. And they find that the people tend to perform better on the test when the phone is in the other room, because even if it's off, when you can see it, there's a part of your mind that's thinking about it, that's wondering what's happening on it. a part of you wants to check it. And so thinking about that just day in, day out, that a part of our mind is devoted to what's going on my phone is, it's just very depressing.
Well, Fran writes, I find that so many of us are so concerned about the politics of today and all the global issues that can change at any moment that we keep checking our smartphones for updates and simply can't do without knowing what's going on. Wow, Fran has me pegged. Paul writes, I keep my iPhone off except when I need to use it, which is almost entirely for making calls. I'm not constantly annoyed with spam or other alerts. The only thing I like about it over a flip phone are the address book and the speakerphone feature, important since cell phone audio is usually terrible. Well, I love that you're getting at sort of bigger life lessons it feels like you learn from this. I was struck also about how your kid said that you were playing with them more during this month that you were on the flip phone, which I could totally relate to as well. But you were talking about how the phone is a gateway to so much that stresses you out, whether or not it's the phone itself, the time you're on it, but that it's a gateway to all of that, I think was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we're meant to carry the internet around with us all of the time. I think it's important that we step away from it and just exist with the people that are in our life and give them your full attention, whether it's your friends or your spouse or your kids or your colleagues.
Yeah, and I guess I would just
go ahead,
jump in to add to that as we're thinking about avoiding or using our smartphones too much, we also then want to think about what we are approaching instead. And for those of us who live with other people and have meaningful relationships, you know, the first thing is to approach those relationships. But sadly, there are more and more people today whose entire identity and existence is in the virtual world. So for those individuals, this endeavor is much, much harder because when they disconnect, there's not necessarily a whole lot there to connect with. And so cultivating that in a new way is going to be really important.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also your point about how while you may feel like you lose some things, other things are gained. And that really was a big point in Keshmir Hill's piece. I was addicted to my smartphone, so I switched to a flip phone for a month. Keshmir, thanks so much for being with us today. Keshmir Hill is tech reporter for the New York Times. Dr. Anna Lemke, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford, thank you as well for being with us. And also Caroline Smith, thanks for producing today's segment. Listeners, thanks for sharing your experiences and your insights and questions. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.